Service of the University of Washington.
From 94.9 KUOW, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. During his 2 decades and more in music, Pearl Jam Stone Gossard has taken time for a number of side projects, including some solo recording. He's going to be our guest later this hour, talking about his new album, which is releasing next month. And at 10 o'clock, our panel of journalists will be here talking about money. In 2009, trace amounts of radiation were detected in buildings at Seattle's Magnuson Park and Old Naval Base. The information about that contamination was not made public until this week. The Navy says it will clean up the areas, but it also says the radiation levels are so low they don't present a public danger. So we got to wondering about radiation levels in our environment and when we're supposed to worry and when we're not. We turned to John Goff, who's radiation safety officer at Swedish Health Services. John, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, no problem.
I guess let's start at the very beginning. What kind of standards are in place for radiation exposure?
Sure. So there is a number of federal standards and state standards in for radiation. The one that we deal with regularly is the occupational dose limit. And those are for individuals that actually work in areas where there is radiation exposure, say an X-ray technologist or a physician, and they're limited to 5,000 millirem per year. That's the actual radiation dose limit that they're allowed to receive as a consequence of working in and around radiation. Most people won't see that type of radiation exposure. Most folks who are exposed for work usually have much lower levels on an average basis. The other limit that we look at is the public dose limit. In other words, if you're not working with radiation, you're not trained to work with radiation, how do we protect those individuals from radiation exposure? And that limit is generally set at 100 millirem per year.
Per year.
So 100 millirem is considered a safe level, if you will, for the general public to be exposed to as a consequence of operations or events or work-type place exposures where we have no control whether or not you're going to receive exposure or not.
Are there different kinds of radiation exposure? For example, you're talking about it perhaps coming from X-rays or various things that are in a hospital. Can it come through the air? Are there different ways that we get exposure?
Sure, certainly. There are man-made sources such as X-ray machines. There's environmental sources such as cosmic radiation from outer space or naturally occurring radioactive materials in the ground. Something to keep in mind is that we're all exposed to some level of radiation regardless of what we do, and that's the natural background radiation. And if you look through various EPA documents or CDC documents, you'll find that on average per capita in the United States, an individual receives about 310 millirem worth of radiation dose.
You're talking about 5,000 millirem a year for hospital workers being the limit. That seems like a lot if 100 is the level for regular people.
Sure. That limit is the regulatory limit, and it was established back starting in World War II, and it's been reduced to some level to some extent over the course of over the intervening years. Something to keep in mind, of course, is that that's a hard limit, and we don't allow folks to actually reach that value. We have some internal controls to look at radiation monitoring for our physicians and our nurses to make sure that they never reach these levels. On average, an occupational worker in the United States probably receives somewhere in the neighborhood 100 to 250 millirem per year above what normal people public members of the public will get. That's just a hard value, sort of the upper line value. But that's also considered, quote-unquote, a safe value because it's a regulatory limit.
John Goff is radiation safety officer at Swedish Health Services. How does radiation exposure affect us? What are the things that we might see?
Sure. So the concern with radiation exposure is that we know that ionizing radiation is considered a weak or low-level carcinogen. It has the potential to cause damage to DNA, essentially. And so if you're exposed to low-level carcinogens, let it be radiation or chemical in nature, what happens is that there's the possibility that cellular repair doesn't occur correctly, and you end up with a cellular mutation. And the biggest concern that folks typically have is that that mutation leads to some precursor cancer, essentially.
And so when we hear reports about radiation in soil or in a contaminated building, when should we as the public worry, and when do we sit back and trust that officials are going to take care of the problem?
Sure. You know, that's a difficult question to answer, because individuals' perception of risk depends on what they feel is acceptable or not acceptable, essentially. We take on risky activity sometimes or unrisky activity sometimes, and we perceive these various risks out there as being more dangerous than one activity or more dangerous than others for whatever reason it happens to be. As far as radiation exposure, something to keep in mind is that unless the doses are very, very high, we're talking hundreds of times higher than the occupational dose level, so we're talking in the neighborhood of 50,000 millirem or 500,000 millirem of radiation exposure, we don't see any physiological effects on individuals. We don't actually see radiation-induced damage. The reason why we get concerned about radiation exposure is because our models that we use for determining the probability or risk of cancer assumes that any amount of radiation exposure leads to some sort of incremental increase in cancer possibilities. Whether or not that's true or not is questionable, but that's the way the regulations are based on. And so we take these sort of probabilistic numbers, say 1 in 10,000 chance, and assign it as a real hard number, saying that really, if we actually expose 10,000 people, one of them is going to get cancer. But that's not necessarily the case when we talk about epidemiology and probability and statistics. What it means is that you have a chance, and if that random probability occurs, maybe you'll get cancer, maybe you won't. What we don't know is who will get cancer and how quickly it will actually occur, and that becomes the problem. These levels are really small, because we have to keep in mind that we're already exposed to radiation, and that the radiation level that I gave you as per capita, the 310 millirem, actually is an average number, and obviously that means that there are variations in that average number, maybe as low as 200 millirem in the United States, up as high as 600, 700, 800 millirem in some areas of the country.
Depending where you live geographically, or what is near where you live?
Depending on where you live geographically and what is near where you live. So a combination of two things. For instance, if you live at higher altitudes, as an example, Denver, Colorado, their average per capita exposure is about 25 millirem more per year than we are here in Seattle, and that's because of altitude.
Is there a way for an average person to measure how much exposure they are getting?
No, not easily. At low levels, it's very difficult to measure, because we have the combination of background radiation that's going to show up on the measurement in addition to whatever you want to measure on top of that. And so even when we're measuring for occupational dose, we have to take into consideration that we have background radiation, and that is going to provide some sort of interference with our signal, basically.
So I can't ask you to comment specifically on Magnuson Park itself, but when we hear reports like this about possible contamination in a public place, how concerned should we be?
It would depend on the level of radioactive material there and the actual radiation exposure being reported. In this particular case, it seems as if this is a relatively small amount of radiation exposure, and what they're attempting to do is probably remediate it down to this 15 millirem level that I see in the article.
Mm-hmm.
And 15 millirem per year is a pretty small number. It would be a number that we would say is inconsequential from a risk perspective, and there would be no significant risk. Negligible risk, essentially, at that point.
Well, I'm wondering if in the attempt to get rid of or cap the contamination, it's something like asbestos removal that you can actually loosen it into the atmosphere. Does it work like that?
Sure, in theory it can, but we have to keep in mind that unlike asbestos, where we don't typically have asbestos in our atmosphere, or at least not in significant quantities, we do have quantities of radiation and radioactive materials in our atmosphere, and we are constantly breathing that in. So unless the levels that we release are prohibitively higher than the levels that are currently in existence, essentially nothing happens.
Huh, interesting. Well, I really appreciate your taking time to share your expertise with us this morning. John Goff is Radiation Safety Officer at Swedish Health Services here in Seattle.
Thank you.
And the Navy, who is cleaning up the Building 27 contamination at Magnuson Park, has said that they're going to do some additional assessments to look to see if perhaps contamination went further than they thought it would. So we'll be following this story here on KUOW Seattle.
It's 9:17. Thin, overweight, obese. Does a person's weight affect their life expectancy? We'll take that up in a minute on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Hi, this is Ari Shapiro from NPR News. You can count on KUOW and NPR to provide intelligent reporting that makes you a more knowledgeable person. KUOW's programs take you beyond the headlines to give you a deeper understanding of important issues. Now is the best time to renew your annual KUOW membership or to make a special gift. Please mail your gift in today or give online at kuow.org. Thank you.
Taking a look at Seattle weather, it's mostly cloudy this morning, currently 55 degrees. Forecast says we'll get some sun later. It'll be partly to mostly sunny this afternoon, getting up into the upper 60s, then overnight cloudy with a low of 51. Tomorrow, Saturday, mostly cloudy with a high of 69. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 9:19. Stone Gossard, guitarist for Pearl Jam, has a new solo record out, his second solo album. We'll talk with him and listen to some of his new music in about 15 minutes.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Zillman. These days we're hearing about new scientific studies that show being overweight doesn't necessarily shorten your lifespan. The studies have sparked a set-to between their authors and some public health experts. Joining us with more on this is science writer Virginia Hughes. She covered the kerfuffle in an article that was published recently in the journal Nature. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Marcy.
Well, let's start off with some of the findings in the study that touched off the debate. It came out of a sort of a statistical analysis, right?
Yeah, there was a study that was released on New Year's Day this year, which is a day that a lot of us are thinking about our weight and dieting and new regimes. So this was a meta-analysis done by a woman who works, she's a statistician from the CDC. Her name is Catherine Flegel. And this analysis was kind of a compilation of the results from 97 older studies. So altogether, this included almost 3 million people. And she basically just looked at BMI, body mass index, which is a measure of weight that is not dependent on height, and looked at the relationship between BMI and death, mortality over, you know, a given period of time. And she found the kind of surprising thing about what she found, although it's not all that surprising to experts in the know, is that people who are in the BMI category that's considered overweight by the U.S. government and the World Health Organization actually have a slightly lower mortality rate than the people in the quote-unquote normal category.
Did she correct for things like smokers or if the people tested were already had some kind of chronic disease?
Yes, so she did. So she's corrected for smoking, age, and sex using sort of the standard statistical calculations to do that. What she didn't do, which some public health experts kind of had a problem with, is she didn't only look at people who had never smoked before. So she kept people in who were smokers, but she just adjusted their values to be, you know, as if they didn't smoke, to account for smoking. So this is sort of a disagreement about math among statistician of how you should look at these numbers.
Well, this really, at least one public health expert out of Harvard came out not just swinging at her, but really saying that it was a load of hooey what she had done, and that's being mild.
Oh, yeah. He went on NPR and said it was, I think his quote was, it's a pile of rubbish. And he actually was quoted in several outlets, international outlets, saying essentially the same thing. And he didn't, when I asked him about it, if he thought, well, you know, in retrospect, did he wish he had not said something so harsh? He said, you know, absolutely not. I stand by that 100%. So he really felt threatened by this study and the attention it got. I mean, to put that into context a little bit, it came out on New Year's Day, and the New York Times did a big story of it on New Year's, and a lot of other outlets did too. It was internationally covered. So he really felt that these kinds of studies are dangerous because he thinks that they give people license to, number one, maybe put on weight or not care about watching what they eat or exercising because it gives the impression that being overweight is better. But number two, he doesn't like the idea that it's all these contradictory studies coming out all the time. People just, his argument is that people just throw up their hands and say, we don't know what to think of these scientists. They're always contradicting each other. Why listen to them at all?
Well, and he has a point there, but she's a credible researcher, correct? It's not like some kind of person who put on her magic ball. This was based on actual science.
Oh, yeah. She's a very credible researcher. In fact, she's been at the CDC studying obesity for a long time. She was one of the people in the 90s who used the CDC data to first show that there was a rise in obesity in the United States and in the overweight category as well.
It seems like there are apples and oranges in this discussion, because I have read various kinds of study findings, and so I agree with this public health expert that it does get confusing. But, you know, it seems like there's solid evidence that links being significantly overweight to some chronic diseases that might include diabetes and heart disease at the very least. And I've also seen studies that say, well, maybe if there's, you know, a worldwide pandemic, people who are slightly overweight have a better odds of surviving it for whatever reason. So it seems like there is not like a hard and fast rule or line in the sand about A, what overweight is, and B, whether it's truly unhealthy or a death sentence. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, coming away from the story, I came away with kind of two ideas that I feel pretty good about, I think. One is that, you know, each of us are individuals, and there are all kinds of examples of people who are overweight and they don't have diabetes and they don't have chronic illness. And on the same time, there's people who are thin and do have those diseases. So these trends that people find over thousands or millions of people in a population are not necessarily, you know, genetics play a big role. And so everybody is different. That's the first thing. The second thing, though, is that it turns out if you look at age, things become a little bit clearer. So this relationship that Flegel showed between, you know, overweight having a lower death rate, lower mortality rate, that is especially true if you're around 50 years old or older. The older you get, kind of the less risk comes along with carrying a few extra pounds, or even many extra pounds. So some people, if you think about it evolutionarily, some people say, well, you know, if you're young and you're overweight, that risk of diabetes and heart disease and all those things, you still have many years of your life to get sick, essentially, and that risk is sort of more important. And as you get older, things like, you know, you want to have a little bit of extra weight maybe so you could counter wasting diseases. And mm-hmm. And if you're 60 and you haven't gotten heart disease yet, maybe you've already kind of won the game there, and you don't need to worry about your weight contributing to heart disease.
Was there a line that was being drawn between obesity and being overweight? I mean, it is more.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So everybody agrees pretty much that if you have, no matter what your age, if you have a BMI over about 30, which is the cutoff for quote unquote obesity, and especially over 35, that is risky. You have a high chance of getting diabetes. You have a high chance of heart disease. So that is a serious thing to worry about. And Flegal wouldn't argue with that at all. Mm-hmm. The question is really this overweight range of 25 to 30.
And
actually, I mean, the normal range, which starts at 18 and a half and goes up to 24.9, the low end of that normal range is incredibly thin.
Mm-hmm.
I think so. There's some question of whether we should be telling people that they should have this ideal of being so thin.
And that's a whole other can of worms.
Yeah.
So it seems then that really at the crux of the public health experts' issue with all of this is that it's not healthy necessarily to eat poorly and to become extremely overweight. And he's worrying a little bit that when you start producing studies that indicate, well, there's not this direct correlation between weight and mortality at, you know, below a certain point, that people are going to get confused and we're going to think it's okay to just go out and eat those chips and chug those sodas?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. But I think it's also that it undermines policy efforts. You know, if studies are showing that maybe the dangers of obesity aren't as big, aren't as dire as we've been led to believe, then maybe, you know, maybe politicians who are considering putting money into anti-obesity campaigns would be less motivated to do so. So I think there's multiple reasons why why people like Walter Willett and public health experts are worried about this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's also, I think a lot of people are coming around to the idea now that the obesity, especially morbid obesity, is very strongly genetic. And once you are morbidly obese, there's been nothing shown to help in the long term. No dietary regimen, no exercise regimen works for more than a year or two. And so if they're not really talking about nobody really thinks that it's just a matter of obese people, not putting soda mm-hmm. down their throat. Mm-hmm. It's more just like preventing it in the first place or whether we should be putting policies in place to prevent it.
Hmm. That's really a fascinating conversation. I thank you for your article, and I thank you for talking to us today.
Thank you. Fun.
Virginia Hughes is a freelance science writer. Her article about the controversy over weight and lifespans in the May 22nd issue of the journal Nature.
It's 9:30, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. After a comedian posted a quote from the movie Fight Club on his Facebook page, a SWAT team showed up at his door. Documentary filmmaker Cullen Hoback investigates how law enforcement uses information from Facebook, Google, and Twitter. His new film is called Terms and Conditions. He'll be talking with KUOW's Ross Reynolds about this today during the noon hour.
Support for KUOW comes from GET, Washington's guaranteed education tuition program, helping parents plan and save for college. With flexible options, a nationwide choice of colleges, and backed by the state of Washington. Information and enrollment online at get.wa.gov.
-54 degrees in Seattle, expecting to get up into the high 60s this afternoon. It's mostly cloudy now. The forecast calls for sun later. 9:31. I'm Bernard Ouellette. A big asteroid is on track to sail past planet Earth later today, and that asteroid has its own moon. More about that in 25 minutes.
It's a song by a Seattle band you might have heard of called Pearl Jam. Been around for a while. From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Marcy Silman. Playing on that record on guitar, Stone Gossard. He also writes some songs, and he's been doing it for more than two decades. Started off years ago in school playing. Formed a band called Green River, then Mother Love Bone, and then that band Pearl Jam. Stone Gossard's had a host of side projects along the way. He plays with the band Brad, and he's got a solo recording career as well. His first solo album, released in 2001, was called Bay Leaf, and the second effort, what they call the sophomore effort, Moonlander, comes out next month, but already the songs are online, one a week. Stone Gossard, it's a pleasure to welcome you to KUOW.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
Is this your first time at our station?
And I think I've been in once before. I think it was a couple of years back.
Well, your rock and roll career actually started around high school, right?
Yeah, I think I started playing guitar probably when I was about 15 years old or maybe 16, and very shortly after that decided that, you know, part of playing guitar was being in a band. That was the big draw, was like getting a band. And
I read you started with mandolin.
That was the first instrument I purchased. I was a mandolin owner,
but not a mandolin player.
I don't know if I actually really learned how to play it. But I think it was really meeting Steve Turner and Alex Shumway, both of whom were in Green River. I went to school with them at Northwest, and they were really into punk rock and a lot of local music, and just inspired by them, particularly the idea that guitar was not necessarily for studied musicians, but that you could, you know, take it and bash out a few chords and have something fantastic happen. And that really appealed to me as a kid.
So I was going to ask you, you're a self-taught guitarist?
Yeah, absolutely.
So what did somebody just say? Here, put your three fingers here, and that's C?
And I've had a few lessons, and I've watched a lot of great guitar players. So, and the really great ones usually have studied as well. So I would preface that by saying, you know, in general, lessons can't hurt, but the idea of sort of discovering guitar just by messing around with it like it's a piece of clay, or, you know, like it's, you know, like you're making a sandcastle. It's just, you just find places that sound good and you hit them until you want to find something else that sounds good. And that really appealed to me about, particularly in terms of songwriting.
This was the 80s, right?
Yeah, this is 1983, 84, 85.
So along with sort of finding your way on the guitar, you started writing songs at that same time?
Almost immediately, I could remember things that I did on my guitar. So I would put my fingers in a certain spot, and I'd, you know, make some noise, and I'd strum it, or I'd, you know, find a little rhythm. And what I was good at was remembering what that thing was, because
I was going to ask you.
I don't even think I had a tape recorder to tape things. So I was just, if I could remember it the next day, then I had a song. And then if I sat down and somebody said, "What do you do?" And I go, "Well, I can do this," or, you know.
Really?
And immediately, you know, in writing music with other people, you'd write your guitar part, and then everyone else would sort of write their part that goes along with it.
So that verb write, did you ever write it down?
No, not a lot of writing. I mean, I might have written down it's an A chord, then a B chord, then a C chord or something like that, but that doesn't really tell you how to play the song.
So was the first band March of Crimes, was that your first official band?
I think that's the first band I joined.
Yeah. Okay.
And I don't think I ever played a show with them, but we rehearsed and sort of wrote some songs together. And it's funny, but March of Crimes is a guy named John Evison is in March of Crimes, who's a Seattle author now.
Yes.
And I get to see him every once in a while, and we have a good time talking. I think he's a fantastic author. I really, really enjoyed his last book.
Was he a great musician as well?
He was a great lyricist. I don't know if he was a great singer. He liked to tell stories, and he was a classic punk rock, 80s punk rock singer. And he probably could have been great, but I think he sort of decided he wasn't really a singer at one point and really focused on writing.
Did you think of yourself as a punk rocker?
Not really. No, I definitely was more excited about kind of new heavy metal at that time, but it was at a time where heavy metal and punk rock were starting to kind of transition into each other. And so, you know, sort of the nexus of that would have been like Motorhead or or you know, the Stooges, I guess, in a sense, but those bands that sort of were straddling that line between you know, sort of butt rock and punk rock.
And was hair metal at that point too?
I mean, growing your hair long was part of it. I think, you know, Green River definitely had long hair. So it was just, it was a cool time because it was basically like you could also like heavy metal and not know how to play. So that was fun.
And this was late-ish 80s, right?
Yeah.
88 or so?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
We're talking with Stone Gossard, and his new second album, solo album, Moonlander, is coming out next month. But over, when we started talking about the 80s, I said 20 years in music. It's essentially almost 30 years in music, right? Yeah, I think I'm right about that. People talk about Green River as the first sort of alternative band coming out of Seattle, but I moved here in 85, and the spotlight hadn't hit the city yet. And what people have described it to me in my memory is that there's a lot of people who knew each other that sort of, it was more permeable. People played together, they played with their friends, people formed bands, and then it wasn't so official as it is now. Is that an incorrect or a correct memory?
I think it's correct. I mean, nobody had at that point, nobody really had record deals or anything to kind of keep bands from doing that. You know, sometimes you get in a band and then you sort of, you're off to the races, you're making a record, mm-hmm. and then you're going on tour, and you have all these sort of obligations that sort of keep you focused on one thing for a long time. And I think it was a, you know, certainly Green River was not the first sort of alternative band in Seattle. All the bands that influenced us, right. Like the U-Men and the Fags, mm-hmm. and 10-Minute Warning, and there's just so many, the Farts. All those bands sort of laid the groundwork for, you know, what we sort of ended up picking up, the idea that you could, you know, make up your own thing and go out and do it. But I think that's right. I think that there was a small scene, and I think there was a lot of people that knew each other within that scene that kind of sort of made moves towards each other.
And were you, when you played with Green River or any bands that came after in a band setting, how were you the songwriter? Was it a more of a collective activity?
I think in every band I've been in, there's been multiple songwriters. I always gravitated towards that and felt real comfortable in that position, is sort of coming up with an arrangement, kind of having this, say, this is the thing that we're going to start out with, and then everybody sort of add on. But since then and over time, every band I've been in, everybody at some point has said, well, I can do that too.
Is there some cachet to being the songwriter?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, if you have a style and a rhythm and a way that you like to hear chords kind of come out, that certainly is important. I think in the long run, you know, it's not really a song until the vocals go down. So at some point, it's like you can have as many arrangements as you want until you have somebody that wants to play along with you. You know, you don't really have that much necessarily. I mean, you might. You know, you could be so great that, you know, whatever you're doing is fantastic. But really, I think the art is figuring out how to take an idea that is yours and then allow sort of a group of people to kind of attach themselves to it in a way that makes it either as good or better than it was to start out with. And that's the real trick to being in a band is, you know, can you make something and have people pull it apart and go, okay, well, this is cool, but I don't like this part, and, you know.
Sounds like marriage.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, you know, and sometimes it's hard to hear how an idea of yours that changed in the group setting actually ended up being better. I mean, sometimes it takes 5 years to kind of go back and go, okay, yeah, now I understand why that's better than it was, you know.
But you have an example of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think... I'd have to think about it, but when you're writing with other people's songs, sometimes you don't appreciate a song. I think probably the prime example would be when we made Pearl Jam made Vitology, mm-hmm. which was kind of the first record where I wasn't sort of the majority songwriter, and I really sort of felt like, I don't know, you know, felt like sort of in my mind I didn't feel like I was being territorial, but I probably was being territorial in terms of, you know, deciding that this is, you know, I'm losing my baby, or, you know,
sure.
or what I do is right, so therefore I should be able to write everything.
Sure.
And I really remember at the time feeling like, I don't know if that's that great of a record. And in retrospect, it was a really important period of time for Ed's songwriting development and Jeff's songwriting development for that to happen. And since then, both of those guys have written amazing songs, and it wouldn't have happened without that sort of moment of them sort of breaking out. So in the long run, it really has benefited, you know.
Benefited the band.
It's benefited the band, absolutely. And it's benefited the band because if I was those bands where it's one guy's writing songs always and there's never a chance of somebody else writing songs, they tend to sound the same after a while. They tend to sound... the arrangements tend to be similar just because that's the nature of people writing music the same. So it's worked out, but you have to kind of accept certain things that you're not maybe at the time ready to accept.
It was very zen. Well, we're going to listen right now to an example of a song that you got to write for yourself. This is the title cut from the new album Moonlander. That's Stone Gossard and some friends, I think, on Moonlander title cut. When did you actually write this song?
This is probably one of the more recent songs, probably within the last couple of years. And actually, it's Barb Ireland on the background vocals there, who's a good friend and a big inspiration for me. She played in the band The Fags, which was, you know, one of the great Seattle art bands back in the day. For sure, one of the cool bands that influenced a lot of people in Seattle, and Hans Teuber too, who's a fantastic horn player and singer, piano player, who's a big Seattle musician for me.
The songs on this album were written over quite a long time period. I think close to a decade, if not longer, right?
Yes, I guess starting in probably late 2002 or 2003.
So right after Bayleaf?
Yep, just kind of, you know, started collecting songs around then and just, you know, stockpiling them.
So were there some songs that you said, okay, this is mine, and some that you could bring the chord progressions to Pearl Jam or to Brad, because you are in a couple of other musical endeavors?
Not so consciously. I think if either of those bands had said, God, we've got to really have this song, you know, I think that I would. But as I write songs and then as lyrics develop and as I put a real personal stamp on them, I think a lot of times those songs are less likely to transition into Pearl Jam or Brad, where sometimes it's better to come in with a little bit less and leave more room for the group to kind of interpret what that's going to be. I've never been great at predicting what songs either of those bands are going to appreciate of mine. So at a certain point, I say, okay, and you know, finally I say, okay, well, now I've got this and I am going to make this my record. But it's not, I don't think I knew that over, you know, 10 years. I think I had those stockpiled, probably played some of them for both of those bands at different times. But eventually I knew I wanted to put a record out. And then kind of as I made that decision and started really going back through and saying, okay, these are the 10 I want to work on or that I think are worthy. I think that's when I made the decision. I was just like going to put those out.
Did I read correctly that Bayleaf came out September 11th, 2001?
That's right. Yeah, it was. I was actually in Manhattan that that day to I flew in the night before and woke up in a hotel, you know, as that was all going down. So that was a sort of a strange circumstance.
How did that affect the reception that record got?
I think that, you know, basically the record company, you know, record business in general shut down after that for about 4 months. So that's a good excuse for me to go, well, otherwise that record would have been enormous. So it would have conquered the world. But Time Out of Mind by Bob Dylan came out that same day.
Yes, too. It did.
It didn't affect that one too much. So.
Well, I mean, he's got a couple of decades on you. No, I think so. Let's hear another cut from Stone Gossard's about to be released Moonlander. I don't want to go to bed. Is this about your daughter?
not really, but I think just that sentiment is a childlike sentiment of, you know, resisting any authority. So it is in the sense that the verbiage might have come from her, but it's not really about her. I'm not sure exactly what it's about, but I think it's definitely somebody locked in their hotel room for too long.
I like that sort of space age electronica that started both the songs that we heard.
Yeah.
It's almost David Bowie-esque.
Yeah, there's some good electronic sounds on that. That's some of that is Steve Moore, a local keyboard player, great trombone player. On that last track was Keith Lowe on the stand-up bass, too, who's another great Seattle musician who I play with in Brad as well.
You decided to release individual songs. You mentioned before we went on the air, 7 of them are online. You could go to pearljam.com/moonlander to find these things. Why did you decide to do it this way? Or was that not your decision?
It was my decision. I think that I want people to hear I wanted to put the record out, and I guess I wanted to promote it to some degree as well. And I think the logic behind doing a song at a time is it keeps people kind of coming back. We can send something out every week and people can kind of hear a bit of the record over the course of a longer period of time. And maybe the first couple things they don't connect to, and maybe later on they do connect to something. And so it just gives the record just sort of a longer period of time for people to kind of go, oh, maybe I'll check that out. So in this day and age, there's a million ways to release music and art, and we're just experimenting with what is it? I've never done that before, so it was more or less, here's a good chance to try something different.
You are a little bit older and wiser than you were when you started out in this world of rock music. What has it given you as a person, not just as, you know, made wealth and fame with Pearl Jam?
That's a good question. I consider myself to be one of the luckiest guys in rock, for sure. Because of the timing and the circumstance of growing up in Seattle and just being around an artistic scene and being exposed to that and sort of digesting the credo of it, which was like, you know, try anything and break the mold and don't listen to your elders, you know, sort of that sort of intensity and having it work out, but having it work out also in a way along with others in a band, and sort of in a band that shares with each other and fights with each other and has to kind of work it out with each other. I think those two things are pretty cool polarities to kind of focus your life on, as the sort of individual sort of I'm God and I can make something happen, or I, you know, don't tell me what to do, versus, you know, here I am with a group of people and what's the best way to kind of work in that group. Everybody sort of having some of that element, and it's been a good experience for me.
Yeah, you've had to do both.
Yeah, you kind of have to wear multiple hats. So, for it to continue on, it really is like a dream to be able to wake up and write songs that are going to come out maybe in a couple of years or a year, to still be making music with a lot of people that I've known for a long time. I encourage people to live and follow their dreams, because it really was nothing more than that for me. A lot of hard work, a lot of sort of persistent, stubborn effort, but nothing that was, you know, it was just stubborn effort. You know, everybody has some of that they can utilize. So, and give and take.
That's your valedictory speech to the graduates of 2013. Stone Gossard's a Seattle-based musician, founding member of the band Pearl Jam, also part of the band Brad. His second solo album, Moonlander, comes out officially on June 25th. The songs are online at Pearl Jam's website, pearljam.com/Moonlander. Thanks for being with us. We're going to go out with a tune from Brad.
Thanks a lot.
Little music from the band Brad. It is Friday, and last I looked, it was kind of overcast. So we turn to Washington State climatologist Nick Bond for his take on the weekend forecast. Hi, Nick.
Hi, good morning.
Morning. So rain, sun, what are we going to see?
Well, we actually have a pretty good weekend ahead of us, and today we look forward to a partly to mostly sunny afternoon, temperatures getting up about where they should be, to the mid to upper 60s. It doesn't look to be quite as tricky a forecast as the last couple of weekends.
So you're feeling confident.
Well, we can't rule out light showers Saturday night, Sunday morning. It looks like they're going to mostly stay on the coast and to the north of us, but I'd give it something like a 20% chance. But still, tomorrow, upper 60s, and again, partly cloudy, partly sunny. Same thing on Sunday. And then early next week, it should warm up a bit, at least into the 70s, and maybe by Wednesday even, you know, hit the 80-degree level. So,
what? You know, wait, say that again?
Yeah, that's right. And so after some really warm weather early in May, of course, we had a cool, damp period there. And so it looks like we've, really kind of turning the corner again on the weather.
Nick, I was interested. You emailed this morning to say that on the state climatologist listserv, you were talking about the National Spelling Bee. And first, I was interested to know that you guys had a listserv. But weather was one of the words.
Well, yeah, one of the words was ombrology. And its definition is the branch of meteorology that involves the study of rain. The root of it is from a Greek word, ombros. It turns out the contestant got it right. Mm. I would hope if that contestant had been from the Pacific Northwest, they would have gotten it right. But
O-M-B-R-O-L-O-G-Y. Are you an ombrologist?
Well, I studied the rain, all aspects of the weather around here.
So,
and in particular, you know, at times, like coming up the next week or so, it's absence.
Well, I like that idea, it's absence. I'm sort of ready for a little break. Well, given that we're going to look at a dry week, you wanted to just touch briefly on our wonderful water supply in the Seattle area and how good we've got it.
Yeah, that's right. And one thing that I think is kind of interesting is in many ways we owe it to the Great Seattle Fire of 1889. And what that did is it revealed the inadequacy of the kind of patchwork of private water companies that were in place at the time and spurred the development of this regional water system that features these mountain watersheds set aside for it that are closed to human activity. And that means a very high-quality water supply, only minimal processing, and really tasty water. And in other parts of the country, you know, the
not true, yeah.
Yeah, it's just not true. And New Orleans, for example, is basically drinking St. Louis's sewage.
I will thank my stars every day that we have the mountain water that we do and hope that the umbrologists in our region continue to study the rain that helps keep those reservoirs full. But we're not going to see them really filling up this weekend. They're just
no. Okay. And out in the distant future, that means next weekend. there's one indication that it could be pretty warm, mostly sunny, upper 70s, and that's from this the European computer model. The American model is much more pessimistic. It turns out the European model is quite a bit better out at those timescales, but it's not always right, so we can't count on that. But still, I think we're looking at some pretty good weather for the next week or two.
Well, thanks so much. I'll hold on to that and look for the optimistic Europeans. Nick Bond's the Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean, and he gives us a weather forecast every Friday here on Weekday on KUOW Seattle. Our journalist panel coming up in the next hour. Don't go away.
$9.59. Social Security and Medicare still facing big challenges. That and more of today's news in a minute. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Symphony, presenting Benjamin Britten's War Requiem on June 13th and 15th, conducted by Ludovic Morlot and featuring two orchestras, three vocal soloists, and three choirs. Tickets and information by calling the box office or online at seattlesymphony.org.
Global warming has become a fact of life in Alaska, where thawing permafrost and rising sea levels are on course to destroy native villages over the next 10 years. 180 are at risk. Will people be moved out in time? And are the U.S. and the rest of the world doing what needs to be done to prepare for climate change? We're going to take that up today during the 11 o'clock hour on KOW.
Support for KUOW comes from Virginia Mason.